again, I just want to pick up as is my wont. People ask me questions, so two things. Someone asked me just to elaborate briefly on what I meant when I said that the Rav, that is Rav Joseph Baer Soloveitchik, was not into the Yom HaTzmaut. Basically, he did not see it as having any religious significance. Let's give you one example. He did not believe that you can say separate prayers. We'll see what Rav Gorin says in a little while. He didn't believe that you could have weddings or simchas or take haircuts because it's a happy event, but it has no halachic significance. Rav Schechter, by the way, disagrees, and on the YU Yom HaTzmaut celebrations, he's involved in the dancing, but Rav Soloveitchik was opposed to that. Then we don't have time to get into it now. It gets into his notion of Zionism, though not having a this-worldly significance, not really a Rav Gorin type of significance that we'll see. We can reflect a little later on. Let me just, before I begin, David is experiencing humming. I don't know if anyone else is. You could try turning down maybe the sound a bit. I'll have to leave that again to, if no one else is commenting on it, to, things are fine from my end. Before I go further, I just want to get it straight. Harvey, are you saying that you're experiencing humming? Okay, so then I'm going to have to go. The problem, if you're wireless, that's a problem also. There's no, what can I say? We've had, since the first class, we've had excellent reception, so I'll keep going. Technical support will be working on it. As I said, if you're wireless, that could be a problem. Otherwise, you might want to try logging in a second time, but I'm going to have to go on. Oh, one more thing. I mentioned this book, so I'll bring it to your attention. Zikaron Basefer. It's written by the current chief rabbi of Moscow. It relates to what we spoke about a number of classes ago. When I say chief rabbi of Moscow, it's not the chief rabbi of Russia, and there's actually two chief rabbis. You always had chief rabbis in the Soviet Union, and these were Talmidei Chachamim until the last one, this Rabbi Sheyavitz, who is not a Talmud Chacham, he's a crown rabbi from the Soviet era. He was trained, the Soviets allowed in the Communist Empire one rabbinical school to be open. That's in Budapest. Budapest was actually, this was a great seminary before the war with some great scholars. There still was a great scholar after the war, Scheiber. It was not an Orthodox seminary, but that's the only seminary that people could go to. It remained in operation and still is in operation. The current rabbi, though, Rabbi Sheyavitz, he, as far as I know, lives a completely Orthodox life. He was at Yeshiva University. About 10 years ago, he spent a month or so. But he's really a spokesman for the Jewish community. After communism fell, they needed to have a posek, one who could do the gittin, one who's involved in kashrus, mikvos, all those sorts of things. So they hired Rav Pinchas Goldschmidt from Switzerland. It's interesting to note also, and worth noting, that Rabbi Sheyavitz had no, he was not exposed as a communist sympathizer or collaborator. There was the case in other places, for example, in Czechoslovakia. The rabbi of the Czech community, after communism fell and they got to the secret police archives, he was exposed as a collaborator, and he had to go. And they appointed a new rabbi. But the same thing that's going on in Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic now, is going on in the Soviet Union, or now Russia, in that although you have Rabbi Goldschmidt, you also have Chabad immediately came on the scene, and there's huge disputes all over Russia because Chabad is taking over. So when I say Rabbi Goldschmidt is the chief rabbi of Moscow, and Rabbi Sheyavitz is the chief rabbi of Russia, they are actually, they not the officially recognized chief rabbis. They used to be recognized, but ever since Chabad came to town and became close to Putin, now the Chabad man is the officially recognized chief rabbi, and there's all sorts of disputes, as there are in Prague. Last year, there was a huge dispute between the official community and the non-official, the Chabad community, which has now taken over, I believe, and the chief rabbi in Prague, who happens to be a convert, by the way, he was able to get one of the Haredi Gedolim, it might have been Rebbe Yashiv or Chaim Konevsky, to support him, but Chabad is still more powerful. So why is this relevant? Because in this book, he has a question, the very question I said that Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Gorin were asked. What about the Jews living all over Moscow? Can they take the subway? And he describes how they could put the, every month there's a new pass and you could sew it into your clothing. And he concludes, that's to be expected, that we can't permit this, but he also says that there were many very religious Jews who did take it, and they were relying on a responsum of Rav Moshe Feinstein that permitted them to do this. He investigated it, he said, and he was told that what Rav Moshe Feinstein ruled was that we don't tell them specifically that people should do this, but we don't tell them not to. That is, it's permissible and they're permitted to do this. It's not something we want to encourage, but Rav Moshe himself held that this was acceptable and that we didn't need to rebuke them. This is not something the Rav held. I shouldn't say this. The Rav never said that you don't tell them it's permissible. He said you don't tell them it's permissible. I don't think he said you tell them not to. And then Rabbi Goldschmidt goes on and says that today, with the fall of communism, it's a different environment. I mean, there's many, many interesting responses in this, and it's a book worth knowing, written dealing with the problems right after communism fell. So it's relevant to what we discussed about. I was in the Czech Republic also during right after communism fell, actually, and but in all those places you had to watch. In fact, I know that the Jews in the Soviet Union, they knew that they didn't even go into the synagogue. They stayed outside the Coral Synagogue because inside it was full of KGB people. Okay, so now I want to pick up, unless anyone has other comments, where we left off, go about 15, 20 minutes on Rav Unterman, and then move into Rav Gorin. Where I ended last class was the story of where this Israel Shahak claimed that he saw a Jew fall down, a non-Jew on Yom Kippur. On Shabbos, and the Jews would not rescue him. Before we go further, I don't know this story about the rabbi in Stockholm using the subway system. Today it's certainly impossible to do, but you can imagine, we already spoke, I don't know if you were around, Doyle, that Rav Uziel gave a permissive opinion, Rav Toledano, and there were a number of Sephardic rabbanim in particular who thought that there wasn't any problem. Rav Goldschmidt concludes that today no religious Jews can do this, but in the communist era it was a different circumstance. Okay, as I said, so Israel Shahak stated that he observed this, that Jews did not rescue a non-Jew. He then admits that it was a fabrication, but it still is the halakha, and this creates a huge dispute or a huge scandal in Israel. What do Orthodox Jews believe? Is it true that Orthodox Jews do not rescue non-Jews on Shabbos? We mentioned the Noah Feldman incident. Rav Unterman felt that he had to respond to this. In fact, he sent a lot of his chief rabbinate responding to canards and attacks on religious Jews and on traditional Judaism. Those who read my letters of Rabbi Weinberg that I published in the Torah Mada Journal might recall that in one of the letters, Weinberg states that Rav Unterman is not able to think deeply about Judaism because he's spending all of his time defending Judaism against the attacks. So this essay that he wrote, which was then reprinted a number of times, and in the 1960s, Emanuel Jacobovitz has an essay in tradition, a whole essay just explicating Rav Unterman's essay. What does Rav Unterman say? Well, first, Rav Unterman begins by quoting the various Talmudic laws, which are instituted either mipnei darkei shalom, that we do these things in order to create peace in the community, peace between Jews and non-Jews, good relationships, and also there are others that are recorded that the rabbi said to do them so as to avoid enmity, mipnei eiva. So are these simply utilitarian? That's the issue. Rav Unterman says that these notions of mipnei eiva and mipnei darkei shalom are not utilitarian. They're basic to Judaism. In fact, he says mipnei eiva, to avoid enmity and to create good relations, are really one and the same. Different rabbis just use different terminology. And you must obey them like any other law. They're basic to Judaism. For example, the rabbi said that we feed the Gentile poor and visit their sick and bury their dead, mipnei darkei shalom. This is not utilitarian ethics. These are rabbinical enactments in order to create good relations. The rabbis trying to increase what's in the Torah, to make good relations, adding as they always do when they see there's a need. These are basic to Torah values. Now, so then what about Shabbos, where we say that we, in theory at least, you wouldn't save a non-Jew, with the exception of Eva? First, Rav Unterman begins by pointing out that Shabbos is not like other laws. It's very, very important, and it can only be violated based on the notion that the person who's violating it will in the future observe more Shabbases. We know that Shabbos is very important, and it's not, you should not assume, just as a matter of fact, that you can violate Shabbos even for human life. As I mentioned last class, the Book of Maccabees records that there were those fighters in the time of the Maccabees who held that one could not violate Shabbos even for human life, and they allowed themselves to be killed. Whether the rabbis had a tradition or whether based on they looked back to the sources and came up with a derivation, the fact is that they derived from, or they at least pegged it to the verse of the Chayvahem, you shall live by them, you shall not die by them. But without, that's one approach, and that's tied in with the approach, according to many, tied into the notion, and directly tied into it, that better violate one Shabbos and observe many Shabboses in the future. Some incidentally see these as two separate different things. But a standard approach is that the two are only tied together. Therefore, if you do not have the notion that you're going to violate one Shabbos to observe many Shabboses, you cannot latch on to the derivation that you violate this, you live by it, therefore you don't die by it. So we see already it's very important. Therefore, there's no justification, apparently, to violate Shabbos for one who will not observe any other Shabboses, and that would apply to a non-Jew. Incidentally, this only would apply to biblical commandments. For rabbinical law, there'd be no reason to assume this. But in theory, one would not violate biblical law for non-Jews. That's what Ared points out is mentioned by people who feel that the idea is you shall violate one Shabbos so as not to violate other Shabboses. That's really icing on the cake. But the real reason is v'chai b'hem, you shall live by them. All I would say is that how do you know? I mean, the other side can certainly reply that you never know that someone's going to die immediately, even if someone's a ghost face or something like that. You don't know. I mean, this is what Rav Unterman presumably would say. Or you could say that it's irrelevant. That Chazal established a principle that we violate Shabbos for Jews on the notion that they're going to observe other Shabboses. And once that's already the principle, we don't make exceptions. Lav dafka. There's no. We don't start saying, well, is this person going to live another week or not? Once they make the rule that we violate Shabbos, because he will observe other Shabboses, then it's applicable, low plug, you know, there's no distinctions. That's how Rav Unterman would explain it. It's not only Rav Unterman. Many people do say that the real justification is precisely that we'll observe other Shabboses, and without that limud, we wouldn't do that. Okay, so here's something about Rav Price. He says, Mahogas Rishonim, I'll have to look on that. That's quite interesting. Yeah, there's other, what about someone who's, is in a coma or something and is not going to ever observe Shabbos. Do you violate Shabbos? There's all sorts of discussions about this. By the way, I'll tell you that according to the rabbis, we do not violate Shabbos for an eight-month-old fetus. For a baby born in the eighth month. Because Chazal had this conception that if you're born in the eighth month, you're really not going to live. They thought this was someone who was going to die immediately. So that would imply that this is, also that you have to wait for the next Shabbos. Today, obviously, that's not the case. And either you adopt the Slifkin approach that Chazal were mistaken, or you adopt the other approach that the nature has changed. Whatever the case is, we see that this was a real concern. Okay, you say Kalmi's keeping, that's not a good example. You could say someone maybe who's insane, who doesn't know any better. There's a number of tshuvot about... we send someone, let's say, to a mental institution and he's going to violate Shabbos. Can we do that? I mentioned in the last class. So you say someone like that who's clearly Machal Shabbos because he's in a situation he doesn't know about Shabbos. I guess, yes, someone in a coma, I guess, is keeping Shabbos. That's not a good example. Thank you. Getting back to Rav Unterman, he says, once we have the principle of Bnei Eva, everything is set aside. I mean, this is an absolute principle. Chazal have the authority. Therefore, even biblical laws, what does it mean then, Mipnei Eva? He says, if you're in a situation where you can explain to non-Jews how important Shabbos is, and that, that in theory we only save it for Jews, because not because we have anything against non-Jews, but because non-Jews have a special exemption that we can violate Shabbos for them because they will observe Shabbos in future Shabboses, and you can explain it to them and they don't get upset with it, fine. Then you go back to the biblical halakha. But in such an environment like we have today, and I dare say in any environment where not, which, and where are you going to find an environment where non-Jews understand this or accept this? In order to prevent enmity, which is the same thing as to increase peace, the halakha tells us, you violate Shabbos. Whenever you have a situation where non-Jews want us to violate Shabbos, and I guess that would be almost any time, we do violate Shabbos. So we will never, Rav Unterman says, we will never have a situation where non-Jews feel offended or where non-Jews are not saved. We will never have a situation where we will not treat non-Jews the same way we treat Jews, because as long as non-Jews feel that that's important, that's what we do. And that's basic to Torah values. The rabbis are saying that any law which leads to enmity is suspended. And this is basic to the Torah. You can even see it as an ethical check on the black letter law if you want. In other words, whatever ethical problems might arise, you have Mibnei Eva, or the Darkei Shalom exemption. The Rav Unterman's chiddush here is that this is not utilitarian ethics. This is basic to Torah values, that we live among non-Jews, and yes, if the non-Jews recognize that Shabbos is important to us, fine. If not, then, I mean, this doesn't solve Rav Soloveitchik's problem, that he has an ethical issue, and that it doesn't matter what the non-Jews say, he still wants to save. But leaving that aside, this is Rav Unterman's position. And, I mean, it is not the position, I'll acknowledge, that's found in many Achronim. It's not the position found in the Mishnah Berurah. However, it is Rav Unterman's position. It was reprinted in many places, and it does seem a coherent understanding, certainly a coherent approach for a modern person who has different values, who has Torah values, but also has values to the outside world, to see these laws as really dependent upon how Gentiles view it. Not that we're trying to get out of doing saving, helping our neighbor, because we want to follow Torah law. But Rav Unterman says, on the contrary, we have to be concerned in order to really follow Torah law in what our Gentile neighbor wants. That was Rav Unterman's big position. He repeated it again in Yeshiva University. That's the thing that Rav Soloveitchik was not happy with, because he didn't see this as really grounded in the sources. And in such a situation, Rav Soloveitchik was happier to live with the problem rather than come up with an idea that he doesn't think is really found coherently in the sources. But I would recommend everyone reading Rav Unterman's approach, because he looks at other examples of Mibnei Darkei Shalom and Ne'eva. And that was his contribution to this whole debate. And really, once you approach matters this way, there should never be another problem again. Other than the fact that maybe you as an individual would not want to be in a situation where the non-Jew says it's okay, don't violate Shabbos for me. But that's another problem. But the issue of the Torah preaching some sort of negative ideology, and the Torah being discriminatory, and the Torah saying we don't value the lives of non-Jews, Rav Unterman turns it on its head and says that this is actually basic, that we consider what the non-Jews want. And that determines, because Torah values good relations. And that's not just something separate, that's internal to the Torah system of logic. Now, he has a few other interesting tshuvot. We don't have time to get into it now. Let me just tell you one, because I found it interesting. When he was asked about Havdalah, what you would say Havdalah on. This is always interesting to me, because when I was young, and we learned in school, that Chamar Medina, that you can say Havdalah, anything that's the drink of the land, something that people drink. Now, my father, who's not a halachic authority or anything, he concluded on his own that in our day and age, what's that? Coca-Cola. That's got to be Chamar Medina. So we began, from when I was young already, saying Havdalah on Coke. And I was a little concerned. I remember, well, maybe it doesn't qualify. So I asked for my tights, and he said, no, it's fine. So here I see Rav Unterman has a tshuva. Can you say Havdalah on lemonade? Which lemonade is even, I guess, it's more even flavored water than soda. And he actually concludes, yes. He says that, what's the definition of Chamar Medina? Chamar Medina is anything that you would drink as a group. As if you had a group of people together, you'd serve them. You wouldn't serve milk, he says. So you can't say Havdalah on milk. But you certainly would serve lemonade, so he says it's fine. Also, one more thing I should note, that Rav Unterman showed that he could be a daring posek as well. And Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg turned to him with a question of Mamzerus in 1965. It was a very difficult case. Rabbi Weinberg knew Unterman for many years. I heard from the late Professor Alexander Altman that Rav Unterman came to Berlin once during the 30s. And it happened to be the day that the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin was having their gathering. They went to a park and they had like a fun day where the students got to go to with their families to have a picnic in the park. And while there, he commented to the students that he's very impressed with the Torah in Derech Eretz ideology in Germany. However, the one problem is there's not enough Torah. There's too much Derech Eretz. And so he knew Rabbi Weinberg at least from the 1930s. What happened was that there was this woman who, after the war, as often happened, she remarried without a get. And she had a child, and the child was a mamzer. And when Rabbi Weinberg was asked this question in 1965, the child was older and was ready to get married. And obviously, posts can try to do whatever they can, but what can you do in a situation like that? The marriage was a good marriage. He had a couple questions. He wanted to know that even if they are mamzerim, is he obligated to publicize it? And he wrote a tshuva. He wrote two, actually, tshuva to Rav Unterman. And Rav Unterman suggests something which is very radical in solving this matter. There is a viewpoint in the Talmud that we have this notion that we can send a get through a messenger. However, what do you do if you send a get? If I send a get to my wife, and then the messenger is already out there bringing it to her, I then go before a group of people and say, I now void the get. I void it. And then she gets the get, and she thinks that she's divorced and she remarries. Well, according to one opinion, that's just bad luck, and the children of Mamzerim. And the Shulchan Aruch says that you can void a get after you already send it. You can imagine the problems this could create. There's another opinion, though, in the Talmud that says that if you void the get, the get is no good. And then the Talmud says, if you void the get is still valid. And then the Talmud asks, well, how could the get still be valid? You voided it. And they say that whenever you get married at the approval, we know, of the rabbis, and it's under their jurisdiction. And the rabbis have the authority to void a marriage. So when the woman gets the get, and she receives it, and then remarries, it's a kosher marriage, it's not because, the get is valid, it's actually the mechanism that Akinu, the rabbis, have annulled the marriage to begin with. So there never was a marriage. And the rabbis have this authority, and this is another issue, we can't go into it now. The Rachman Beis Din, the whole basis of the Rachman Beis Din is that the rabbis have the authority to annul marriages. And we know they have the authority to annul marriages. They do it a few times in the Talmud. The question is, under what circumstances they have this authority? Well, Tosfos, right there in the Talmud, says that this could be a possible solution for Mamzerus cases. Because every time there's a Mamzer, you take the original husband and wife, and the husband sends a get and then abolishes and then voids the get, and we know that the marriage then is regarded as a void from the very beginning. Ergo, the woman was never married. The children she had were out of wedlock, but in Judaism that's not an issue, out of wedlock children. They're kosher children, 100%. So when she marries, it's her first marriage. And the Tosafot leaves it at that. The Maharsham, he died in the early 20th century. He's one of the greatest poskim in the late 19th and early 20th century. Some people call him the Poseg Achron in Galicia. He was also a liberal Poseg, even a very liberal Poseg. He was quite attacked, quite sharply, by other Poskim. Rav Soloveitchik once was asked, especially he had Treifos, all sorts of kulas, that his grandfather had all sorts of leniencies also. How come his grandfather was never attacked so viciously like the Maharsham was attacked? And the Rav replied that my grandfather was smarter than the Maharsham. The Maharsham wrote all of his kulos. The Maharsham, there's like six volumes of Chuvos Maharsham. His name is Sholem Mordechai Shvadron. Now, his grandson, or maybe great-grandson, was a famous Magi preacher in Jerusalem who passed away a few years ago. So the Rav said, Rav Chaim, he was smarter. He knew not to write all of his leniencies. Now, the Maharsham was asked the question, and he was asked after the fact when the rabbis had already made the decision, so it wasn't practical, but he said, had you asked me earlier, I could have suggested l'halacha v'olamaisa, which means from theory but not in practice, we could rely on the Maharsham. And there's a big debate. What does that mean in theory and not in practice? Some say it means that he would only do it if other rabbis agreed with him. Others say, well, no, it means that it was only a theoretical thing. In any event, he offers this as a possibility. Rav Unterman in his tshuva tells Rabbi Weinberg, Practically, this is how we solve the mamzerus problem with this these children, with this child. Do the advice of the Marsham, void the get. Yes, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't give that, but this is an exceptional case. We could do it. And Rabbi Weinberg didn't want to accept this. He says we can't accept it. But Rabbi Unterman decides halacha l'maisa. That's how you get rid of mamzerus. Now, I assume Rabbi Unterman did this because he knew things that other people didn't know. What do I mean? There were other great rabbis who used this. Let me tell you one case. And for this case, we actually have witness testimony for Tzvi Pesach Frank. We have someone, grandson, he gets Tzvi Pesach Frank on the phone, listening to us now. He can confirm it. But Rav Aaron Pachenik, he's from America, but then he became a big macher in Heichal Shoma. I have a letter from him. He's a leading Mizrahi figure in which he says he has witness testimony that Tzvi Pesach Frank did this. Again, another case that Tzvi Pesach never published in his writings. Great poskim often don't publish everything they believe or everything they conclude because they don't want abuses. Look, the Nitziv, Rav Chaim Ozer points out that the Nitziv of Elozhin, Yitzhak Chanan, never published his famous tshuva permitting sale of the land that everyone relied upon because he thought that maybe, like today, he wouldn't want you to rely on it. What was the case? Again, a case, it's not like today, where we have computers and all this. After World War II, you didn't have, if they had computers and everyone could easily find their spouses and siblings, there were various lists. You had the Red Cross list, you had all sorts of lists, Vad Hatzalah, and people would check on all these lists to see if they had family that survived. But even today you hear stories about people who finding relatives. They didn't have computers, and there was this man who survived, and he came to America, assumed that his wife was dead, got permission to remarry. His wife went to Israel, ended up in Bnei Brak, which, as we mentioned last time, was a very small town, small area. And she, too, was given halachic permission by great poskim to remarry. After all, poskim deal with what they're given. If you have a case, for example, you're in an extermination camp, Auschwitz or something, and a group of prisoners are put on a truck, and they're brought out one day to go, supposedly to go do work, and the truck comes back and it's empty, and that you give this decision. And there have been plenty, if you read the works of tshuvos of rabbis with agunas, they made decisions like this all the time. The truck came back with no one on the truck. They concluded that everyone was killed and allowed the person to remarry. But there were some people who survived. There was a person in Scranton where I'm sitting right now who passed away a few years ago, and he would speak to my Holocaust class each year. He has a bullet hole, you see it in his arm. He was put in the pit. He came from the city of Kielce in Poland. He was shot together with hundreds of others, you know, the sardine method they called it. They'd all fall in. But he wasn't dead. He was only injured. And that night, he and one other prisoner who were still alive got up. They made their way out. They found their way to a non-Jewish woman's home, and then she helped them. And he survived the war in the forest. He wasn't married, actually. It's a sad story because after the war, he did marry. He went back to Kielce, and his wife and baby were one of the 60 Jews killed in the Kielce pogrom after the Polish people did not want Jews coming back to many of the Polish towns, and they didn't want them, and in Kielce there was a terrible pogrom. But here's a case where if he was married, his wife would have been given a heter 100% by great poskim, and yet he would still be alive. The story, so the man comes to Israel, it was in the 60s, or late 50s, I'm sorry, it might have been 1960. This made all the newspapers, and he's walking in Bnei Brak, which, as I said, you know, you go to Bnei Brak, it's the new Torah town, and lo and behold, he sees his wife, or the one who was married to him. This woman is married now with, I believe it was one son. The son is learning in Ponevej Tzairim, in the Ponevej Yeshiva. And here he's a mamzer. What can you do in a case like this? The reports are that it went to Ratzi Pesach Frank, and Ratzi Pesach Frank, who was not a post-egg to shy away, who you have post-scheme, certain post-scheme, who say, I can't deal with this, he dealt with everything, and he ruled that he relied on the Marsham, the man gave a get, and then voided the get, and it was that she was never married. Eliav Shochetman, he's a professor of Hebrew law in Israel, another really great scholar, he's the grandson of Rav Kaniel, who was the Rav of Haifa. He told me, without even knowing the story of Ratzi Pesach Frank, that he knows from his grandfather that there were other Rabbanim who after the Holocaust used the view of the Marsham to get rid of some of the real problems in Mamzerus. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. There are many other interesting things in Ravuncha Mizrahi's. We don't have time to go into them, but I think we did succeed in touching really what made him important. He was the leader of religious Zionists for many years. Unlike Rav Soloveitchik, he wasn't a theoretical Zionist. He was living in Israel. He was deciding the questions that the state of Israel, you know, when with regard to halakha and the state of Israel. And yes, he was subjected to all sorts of pressures, the sorts of pressures that Rav Soloveitchik didn't want to be subjected to. But he was really living in the front lines and trying to keep orthodoxy. It is not like today when it wasn't powerful, still a force to be reckoned with. So with that, unless anyone has any questions on Rav Unterman, we'll go on to Rav Shlomo Goren, one of the most interesting Gedolim, fascinating figures in the 20th century. In fact, in many ways, his life story is tragic, as we'll see. And many would argue that it was his personality that had certain flaws, fatal flaws even, that led to the problems we'll see, that led him, that prevented him from getting his due. I have almost all of his books, and you're dealing with someone really a genius, and he's used, his works are used all the time. I know for a fact that the Art Scroll and their Yerushalmi, their edition now, they use Rav Goren's Perush on Brachos. Of course, they'll never cite it, but I know for a fact, yes, how I know for a fact, no, because I know someone works on in there, that they have it. He has three big volumes on Chumash, on holidays, and other issues too, but just take an issue like Shavuos or Purim, and the way he formulates it, he'll start with an idea, and he has different categories, and then he'll have different sections, and he really formulates it, he has a secular education, the way we do in the academic world. Torah HaMoedim, Torah Shabbat HaMoed, one other work. These are works that, if you're ever looking to give a shiur, you have to give a shiur for an hour. You pick up one of his books, and you have a perfect shiur on any area. And I guess, as Professor Sperber said when he was in Toronto, that's the definition of a classic, when people plagiarize from you. And I know there's lots of plagiarism going on from Rav Goren's books. Recently, just last year, a book came out about him in English. And it had, here it is, with a classic picture of him in front, in his army uniform, blowing shofar, the day in 1967 when the old city was taken and the Kotel was taken. It's a classic picture, famous, not so well known, is that he was actually the first one into Hebron. And it was he who opened up, who broke into, they couldn't get the key, into Maras Machpelah, and he actually took the surrender from the Arab mayor. There was no one else there. He zoomed ahead on his jeep, ahead of the soldiers and ahead of the tanks, and made it into Hebron. We'll get back to that. But let's first look at his biography. He was born in Poland in 1918, and his first name is Goruncik. His earliest writings is published under the name Shlomo Goruncik. His father was a Gera Chassid. Now this is important. First of all, the Gera Chassidim were the largest Hasidic group in Poland, and I'm told that today they're the largest Hasidic group in Israel. We know that in Agudas Yisrael, he really controls matters, the Gerer Rebbe. It's a very interesting this Gerer Rebbe, unlike previous ones. He won't talk to you, literally won't talk to you if you're not a Shomer Shabbos. So politicians want to come speak to him, and he won't talk to them. They have to send the Shomer Shabbos politicians to speak to him. In any event, he's very powerful. And people have written on it claim that there was approximately 200,000 Gera Chassidim in Poland before the war, an enormous number, and he was the leader of them, really like their monarch, and virtually all of them were killed. The story of the recreation of the Gera dynasty after the war is just like the creation of Satmar that we spoke about last semester, two semesters ago, almost from scratch. If you read Rabbi Lau's autobiography, he speaks about meeting the Gera Rebbe, and he came, he had nothing. In Poland, as I said, the Rebbe had enormous power. Rav Avraham Mordechai, the Re'im, he was able to escape and make it to Eretz Yisrael in 1940, and this raises all the questions we can't get into now of here you leave, a Hasidic Rebbe leaves his flock. Is that moral? And we spoke a little bit about that, although we have to know the followers wanted him to leave. And they wanted him out. No, Alexander wasn't. You had large Hasidus in Poland, but no, Gerers by far the largest Hasidus in Poland. Alexander was not an important Hasidus like Ger. You had other Hasidus, certainly in Poland. You had many Hasidus in Poland, but Ger was by far the largest one in Poland. He was the most important Rebbe. You had, I don't want to get into now, if we do a class on different Hasidic groups, many of them no longer even exist. I don't even know if there is an Alexander Rebbe anymore, but Ger was by far the largest one. Alexander's close to Ger. In ideology, things of that nature, but the Ger Rebbe was the most important. He died in 1948, and he's actually buried. You wouldn't know if you just walked by it. There's a small courtyard near Machane Yehuda where he is buried. Now, what's special about him, and what influenced Rav Goren's family, is that unlike many Hasidic Rebbes, the Reim Rav Avraham Mordechai was a great lover of Eretz Yisrael. I'm glad to hear Alexander still exists, but it certainly is not a power on the Hasidic scene, like many of the other groups. When you think of Hasidic groups, you think of Belz, you think of Satmar, you think of Gur, or Ger, you think of Chabad, you think of many, many other Hasidic groups. Think of even Amshinov. Amshinov's a nice group. Babov. You think of Beyond. And you can see who's important. Visions and others. If you look at who they put on the Agudas Yisrael, Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. Again, the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, you don't have to be a Gadol Yisrael, you don't have to be a great Torah scholar, but you have to have a nice flock that'll listen to what you say and you can deliver the votes. That's what it takes to get put on if you're a Hasidic Shrei. That doesn't mean that none of them, or even all of them, are not Talmidei Chachamim, but that's not why they get put on it. They get put on it because they're powerful religious figures. Rav Avraham Mordechai and all the Ger Rebbes were great lovers of Eretz Yisrael. The Ger, of course, if you know Sfas Emes, that's from Ger. The Ger Rebbe was one of the leaders of Agudas Yisrael, but Aguda had two types of leaders. Aguda had people who were not lovers of Eretz Yisrael, thought that it was okay to stay in Chutz Laaretz until God brings us back, were very anti-Zionist. You think of people like Rav Chanan Wasserman. And Aguda also had people who were great lovers of Eretz Yisrael, who really were very able to coexist and to cooperate with Mizrahi, and when they came to Israel, really were not that distinguishable from many Mizrahi figures. I'm thinking of Rav Ishel Zalman Meltzer, the Ger Rebbe. The Ger Rebbe sent many of us succeeding to Israel. He himself went to Eretz Yisrael about six times, four of those in the lifetime of Rav Kook. He bought incredibly valuable property. It wasn't valuable then, but he bought a lot of property, especially in Tel Aviv. He now is a very wealthy man, the Ger Rebbe. They have very expensive property in Tel Aviv, which is now rented out. And he was a lover of Eretz Yisrael. So that obviously influenced not just all of his Hasidim and Rav Goren's family. His father was a Ger Chassid. During this trip to Eretz Yisrael, these trips to Eretz Yisrael, he developed a wonderful relationship with Rav Kook. And he writes that, you know, people in Chutz Laaretz think Rav Kook is some modernish, a modern rabbi. They don't know who he is. He explains his disagreements. He has a famous letter in which he explains his disagreements with Rav Kook. He thinks Rav Kook is too open-minded for the non-religious. But the way he describes Rav Kook, the terms he uses, is incredible. And he developed a very close relationship to Rav Kook, a very close relationship to Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap and others. In general, the Ger Hasidim have always given Rav Kook great respect. After all, the Rebbe gave him great respect. So eventually the Aguda split between the Ger elements, who are much more moderate, and the Aguda in Eretz Yisrael was really a Eda Haredit, extreme anti-Zionist organization, because the German Orthodox, you know, the German Aguda were anti-Zionist. That eventually splits. And it's not just the Ger, the Polish Hasidim in general were not like the Hungarians. They had a great deal of love and respect for Rav Kook. That doesn't mean they agree with everything he said, but they were in Rav Kook's side in a lot of these disputes. Had he not had such a large flock in Poland, the Ger Rebbe himself would have come to Eretz Yisrael. So it isn't surprising that Rav Goren's family comes to Eretz Yisrael, and they actually settled in a place that soon will be called Kfar Hasidim. All sorts of Hasidim settled in this Kfar Hasidim. The family would later live in Jerusalem and in Rehovot. And as a youngster, Rav Goren was already doing various tasks for the Haganah, which was the Jewish defense. There was all sorts of Arab marauders and all problems in the Yishuv. When he was 12, he entered the Hebron Yeshiva, which had just moved to Jerusalem after the 1929 riots. It moves to Jerusalem, and Rav Goren enters it. And in those days, you didn't have many yeshivas. You only had three yeshivas. You had the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, led by Rav Zalman Meltzer. You had the Chevron Yeshiva, and you had the Merkaz Harav Yeshiva of Rav Kook. Now, the Chevron Yeshiva is the Sobotka Yeshiva. Sobotka Yeshiva, the great Sobotka Yeshiva from Lithuania, when Lithuania as a state comes into being after World War I, there's problems with the draft. They're afraid their students are going to be drafted. So the yeshiva settles, a branch of the yeshiva goes to the land of Israel, and Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein and the Alter Sobotka, they come and they leave Rav Sher, the son-in-law of the Alter, back in Sobotka. So you really have two branches of the Sobotka yeshiva, and people would come to Israel because they love Eretz Israel. You had Americans who came. You actually had three Americans killed in the Sobotka in the Hebron riots, including one from Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, another was the son of one of the big rabbanim in of Chicago, Rav Chaim Epstein. And you also had the yeshiva in Sobotka itself, and a great dispute breaks out, by the way, between the yeshiva and the Rav of Sobotka. If you go to the Sfarim blog about a month ago, there's a posting about this. So Rav Gorin enters it. Now, the problem with the Chevron Yeshiva is they have many great graduates, but knowing what the Chevron Yeshiva is today, firmly in the Haredi world, they can't take credit or can't take pride from any of these graduates. Rav Gorin is one of them. You have people like Rav Avram Shapiro, the late chief rabbi, Chaim Herzog, the president, Menachem Elon, former Supreme Court Justice, Yisrael Tashma, the great Yisrael Tashma, Dr. Ephraim Shach, the son of Rav Shach, Professor Sperber. I believe we even have another, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. David Lando is listening to us. He also is an alumnus of Chevron, although you can correct me. The problem is that all these people came out of Chevron, and many more that I'm not mentioning, they no longer fit the model, or they don't fit, I shouldn't say no longer, they don't fit the model of Chevron Yeshiva Bachar of today, and therefore they can't take credit or can't take pride in them. And yet they'll have to tell you that all these people, different temperaments, different ideologies, they're very typical of what came out of Chevron, because Chevron was not a Haredi yeshiva like we think today. In fact, there wasn't such a thing as Haredi yeshivas as we think today. Chevron was a yeshiva. Sorry, we have another. I don't know, Dr. Lando, if they will take credit or take pride in you, but we can. In any event, it was not a Haredi yeshiva. You had all sorts of people there. You had plenty of religious Zionists. In general, the Alter Sobotka kept out of politics. Religious politics. It was important for political reasons also, because you had to get money from everyone. So many yeshivas wanted nothing to do with politics. But in any event, you had all sorts of religious Zionists who go to, there was a very strong religious Zionist presence at Chevron Yeshiva, as there was at all the yeshivas, at Tel's, at Sobotka in Europe, at Nir. They all had a strong religious Zionist presence. Many people might be surprised. You meet these modern Orthodox rabbis, you meet these religious Zionist figures, and they tell you that they studied in Nir or at Tel's. It's not that they became rebels. The Litvisha, the Lithuanian Torah world, was not like it is today. It was a world that had plenty of disagreements and all sorts of matters. And even in Klesk, where Aaron Cutler was, you had religious Zionists, and in fact, Aaron Cutler, this was written up a few years ago by Yoel Finkelman, he actually expelled someone because you were not permitted to publicly be involved in religious Zionism. This person was a public religious Zionist. So what happened when he publicly, when he expelled from the yeshiva? He went then and he lived in Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer's house, from Cutler's father-in-law, who was much more sympathetic to religious Zionism. No, I would not say. Sobotka was, when you say, was moderate in Europe. Tel's was full of revolutionaries. Mir had all sorts of people. I wouldn't say that Sobotka was more moderate. All these yeshivas had all sorts of people in them. Sobotka preached in moderation, and that, unlike Nevardek. Nevardek was an extremist place, and that they wanted to totally destroy your self-image. And Sobotka had a reputation as a place where maskilim could go, because it was very intellectual, and that they you could dress very, the latest styles. But Litvisha, the Lithuanian Torah world in general, had an open-mindedness that we don't see today. And you had all sorts of people coming from the yeshivas. But I'll agree with you that Sobotka was probably the most open of all these places. And I think not because of the administration per se, but because they attracted all sorts of people. And you had extremists who came out of Sobotka as well. Plenty of Hasidim, incidentally, came to the Litvish yeshivas. You did not have yeshivas in the Hasidic world. That's a question in and of itself. And the Hasidim never established yeshivas. And so if you wanted a yeshiva, you had to go to Lithuania. While he was at Slobodka, Rav Goren was recognized as a genius. And at 17, quite young age, he published a sefer, a commentary on one section of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. He's the apple of Rav Kook's eye and Rav Isserzal Meltzer's eye. I mean, to publish at age 17, I'm not talking about things like yeshiva guys, state published stuff. We're talking very high level material at age 17, and you read what's written about him in the periodical literature of the time, read the Haskamas. He's going to be the next Gadol Hadar. The predictions are that he's the great genius. In 1935, when he's 18, he begins attending classes at the Hebrew University, which is a very small institution in Mount Scopus. But we see already he's not like the others, not like the other Gedolim that we know of today, although he's not far removed from the image of many Lithuanian Torah figures who did go, although not necessarily all to the universities, they went to gymnasiums, for example, in Tells. There was a gymnasium in Tells where you could study secular subjects. And it was common for the yeshiva students to do that. What did he study there? Well, among other things, he studied Greek, he studied classics, and he has a whole volume. One of his works of Torah is on Jewish philosophy, and you see he's quoting Aristotle, he's quoting the pre-Socratics, I mean, he's quoting all the various philosophical literature. Usually people write about Jewish philosophy if they know something, if they've educated themselves a little because they want to speak intelligently about Jewish philosophy, they'll know a little bit about Aristotle. Because if you want to speak about the Rambam, you have to know a little Aristotle, then know a little bit about Plato, because Plato's quoted. However, they don't know anything about the pre-Socratic philosophers, they don't know anything about all the other Greek philosophers who the Rambam didn't know and doesn't mention. You see from this that Rav Goren does know, and he's quoting them, and these are actually, many of these articles in this book are records of lectures he gave at the Technion and other places. He taught philosophy, Jewish philosophy, but it was more than just Jewish philosophy. Because if you want to teach a good Jewish philosophy course, you want to explain, you know, where the Greek ideas came from, to then discuss what the Jews were responding to. So very interesting. It was at the university that he met his future wife, the daughter of Rav David Cohen, the Nazir. And I hope in a future class to focus on the Nazir, who another very important figure. And Rav Goren then becomes very close to the Nazir. He adopts some of the Nazir's practices, for example, vegetarianism. Rav Kook was not a vegetarianism, contrary to popular belief. Rav David Cohen was a vegetarian, and Rav David Cohen's two sons, Rav Shar Yashav and Rav Goren, are lifelong vegetarians. In 1936, the Arab riots begin. Jews suffer terribly also in these Arab riots. And he joins the Haganah, which protects Jewish settlements. He was known as a great shot. So here we have a Torah scholar of immense proportions also being a soldier. Already you see he's not like a typical Torah great. We all know that yeshiva students refuse to go to the army, refuse to do army service, refuse to take part in what most people, certainly listening to this broadcast, would regard as basic to what it means to be a citizen. And here we see that Rav Goren has a very different approach, and we'll get back to this, doesn't see any contradiction between being a soldier and being a Torah scholar. On the contrary, he sees this following what we spoke about with Rav Kook earlier, that what was King David? He's portraying the Talmud as a Torah scholar and also fighting the wars of God. Rav Goren sees this as in the Rav Kook's model. He becomes a big follower. That's what it's not enough today just to be a Torah student. In fact, you cannot only be a Torah student in modern times if you want to be a real religious Jew. You must be involved in society and civilization, and that means you must be part of the army. That's called, you know, it's one thing in Golos when you're in Poland. That's what it means to be a religious Jew. You sit and learn Torah. Everything else is only utilitarian. It helps you, you make a living, all those sort of things, but none of them have absolute value. But when you're living in the land of Israel, it's not just enough just to be a Torah scholar. You must be a part of the society, and that means when there's a war, you go out to war as well. And he did that. And we see that this approach, we see this from when he's very young, so it isn't something he came to later in life. In 1948, he's appointed chief rabbi of the Israel Defense Forces, which were just formed, and he holds this position until 1972. Obviously, you need to have rabbis in the Israel Defense Force, you need to have chaplains, like every army does. He was the one, though, it's not, his job isn't like other chaplains. What's the job of a chaplain? You're supposed to go speak to soldiers, or give them religious inspiration. He had a much more practical job, in addition to all of the other things. He had to insist that there's kashrus. He had to make sure that the entire army was kosher. Today, it's taken for granted. But this was there was no assumption when the army was formed that it would necessarily be kosher or entirely kosher. Some people had the assumption that you'd have religious units and non-religious units. And the non-religious units, of course, would not be kosher. Rav Gorin was able to help ensure that the entire army was kosher. And the Ben-Gurion, who had a liking for Rav Gorin, as I mentioned last class, he had this he had a quaint view of religious Jews. He thought that they were going to be disappearing, but he was willing to, I guess in a paternalistic way, give in to their requests. It shows him as kind of having a sense of paternalism, being a good leader. One of the big problems now is he gave in to the Chazalish's request for the 400 students that they now, how many students? 11% of the population gets exemptions now. But he never dreamed that this would turn into this. So Rav Gorin is able to make the entire army kosher. Religious Jews' needs are not overlooked. Every army base is going to have a synagogue. Every army base was going to have sidurim. It's going to have a Torah. And all the things necessary to being for religious Jews. And Ben-Gurion doesn't want to split in the population. He wants religious Jews to have that which they need. And it was crucial to Rav Gorin that there not be a Nachal Haredi. Rav Gorin was very opposed to the notion that there would be religious units. There were many religious Zionists who thought you could never serve in a unit with non-religious. There's too many problems. We need to have a unit, they said, in which where Shabbos is important, where Kashrus is important. And yes, they did believe in fighting and being in the army, but religious units have to be separate from the non-religious. Rav Gorin said that this is going to create a split in the Jewish people. We must all fight together, we must all live together, and we can develop an army that religious Jews' needs are taken into account. We're not forcing the non-religious to do anything, but our needs are also taken into account. The army must be integrated. In one of his controversial steps, that is religiously, okay, so Sifla tells us there were B'nai Akiva Nachal units, and there were many people, and then Nachal Haredi is, apparently they tell me that in Nachal Haredi, there's no Haredi in it. These are religious Zionist Hezer types who don't want to be involved in army units where there's women, where there's no respect for traditional Judaism. But this, Rav Gorin was opposed to this. In one of his controversial steps, he created a unifying Nusach. What do you do when Ashkenazim and Sephardim are together? Well, in the Haredi yeshivas, all public davening is Ashkenazi. That's, I don't even, because the yeshiva itself is regarded as an Ashkenazi yeshiva. Even if the majority were Sephardi, the Chazan would daven Ashkenazi. In the Hezder yeshivas, and I mentioned already in a previous class that this is one of the great achievements of the Hezder yeshivas, and of religious Zionism as a whole, the disputes and the tension between Sephardim and Ashkenazim have been totally eliminated, and in the religious Zionist world, Ashkenazim and Sephardim marry, intermarry, if you want to use that term, with no problems, and it's very wonderful. You do not have that in the Haredi world. There still is a great deal of discrimination, and no Ashkenazi is going to, yeshiva is going to look kindly upon being set up with a Sephardi girl. I mean, they have real problems there. So in this religious Zionist world, the way it works is who's ever the Chazan, if there's a lot of people, whoever, if there's a lot of Sephardim and a lot of Ashkenazim, basically evenly divided, whoever is the Chazan, that's the Nusach you use. And if you're an Ashkenazi and the Sephardi is davening, so privately you say your version of Shmoneh Esrei. Thank you. Simcha. Rav Gorin said that this is not acceptable, that we have to be unified, integrated. So he developed what's called a unified Siddur. I don't know if anyone still uses it. When I was in Israel, we went to army for like a week. They wanted to train us so that we could use weapons. And there still were these unified sidurim that people used. I don't know if today anyone used it. Rav Avad Yosef has a response to them saying it's forbidden to use it because you have to, each part of Judaism, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, Yemenites, have to keep their own traditions. And here we see Rav Goren willing to do new things because, from his perspective, Rav Avadia's perspective, of the Ashkenazim have to remain Ashkenazim, Sephardim have to remain Sephardim. That's all fine and dandy when you're living in Poland and when you're living in Iraq. But when you come to the land of Israel, what we need is a new Eretz Yisrael Judaism. Rav Goren is going to create Eretz Yisrael Judaism with Eretz Yisrael Halakha, as we'll see. And one of the elements of Eretz Yisrael Judaism is no more Minhagim. Everyone's going to have the same sort of Minhag. Now, Rav Avadia, if he had his way, he'd say, I guess everyone's Sephardi. Everyone will be a Rav Yosef Karo person. But from Rav Goren's perspective, that's not how it works. We must unify. Take some from Ashkenazi, take some from Sephardim. And he created a Sidur that will be a unified Sidur. You got it all years ago. Yeah, they might still have it in the army. I don't know. When Rav Goren left, a lot of things changed. They still had it in the 1980s. Okay. Rav Goren did other things, which shows his ingenuity. He wrote special prayers. Let's say you're in the submarine corps. Before you go off in the water, there's a special prayer for the submariners, a special prayer for the Air Force, a special prayer for the Navy. He's making Judaism relevant by creating special prayers for different people in the Army, for the tank crews. I mean, this is a rabbi who recognized that Judaism is not set in stone, that you can have innovations. Within halakha, obviously, but innovations that speak to individuals. That's one of the big problems of Judaism. They were constantly saying prayers and reciting things that were written so long ago, and Rav Goren is saying that we also, yes, we don't get rid of those, although we'll see that at least in one case he says we do get rid of them, but we have to make it relevant. It was during his years in the army that he began to publish Torah articles constantly. The army had a periodical, I don't know if it still exists, called Machanayim. I guess from Machaneh, from army base. And it came out every month, I believe. No, it came out four times a year. And Rav Goren had essays on various halachic or hashkafic themes in each one of the essays, in each one of the issues. And many of these essays are now collected, probably all of them, in his various books. During this time in the army, he begins to develop his great following. I mean, who usually has a following? Rosh Yeshiva, rabbis of cities. But Rav Goren becomes one of the most important religious Zionist rabbis. We mentioned that of the older generation, you have the Rav of Soloveitchik, who, again, I don't think he's that important. In fact, I'll take that back. He's not important at all. In Israel, Rav Soloveitchik had no importance. There were no classes on him. There was no, people didn't read him. He had no significance. You had intellectuals who were interested in him. But until about 20 years ago, when people started speaking about him, David Hartman was the first one when he comes to Israel, he starts speaking about Rav Soloveitchik. He was not an influential figure. The Torah Education Department, the Jewish Agency, begins publishing some of this stuff. But who were the important religious Zionist figures? You had, in these years, in the early days, you had still Rav Harlap, you had Rav Unterman, you had Rav Moshe Svineria. There were a number of people. It was not Rav Soloveitchik. And you had Rav Goren. Yes, let me point out, because we're going to have to end now, and we'll take some questions. In the next class, we're going to pick up with really what makes Rav Goren so significant and how he used his army bully pulpit. What Sahal published, its own edition of Tanakh, is actually interesting because I use it sometimes in a lecture. If you want to do, let's say, the codes, and you take the Sahal edition and you start counting, you see it doesn't always work because the Sahal edition is not the same edition you have at home. It's based on the Leningrad edition, which is one of the was thought to be the closest to the Ben Asher manuscript. It's probably the most widely used or the most popular Tanakh in the world because every recruit in the IDF is given it. You might have seen it's a little blue Tanakh. I don't have it here. I have it at home. And yet it's not exact. There's extra vavs and things, so it's not the same exact thing that we have when we use our Torah, which I think is interesting. Because if you're reading Kriyas HaTorah, if you're using a Torah scroll, I don't know what you compare it to, but yes, every soldier is given a Tanakh, as you'd expect. I would assume every soldier is also given a prayer book also. What else would you expect from a Jewish army? Yes, the blue one. Any comments or questions? We've already reached 10 o'clock. We still have a lot to do with Rav Goren. The plan, at least, is to finish Rav Goren next class. I don't know if it'll happen. And then move two classes on Yosef Kafach. But if not, certainly we're not We have plenty of time. See, it's taking a few seconds from the time people type questions so they actually appear on the screen. So, you asked about his work on the Yerushalmi. He has actually been accused. He wrote a work, as with Rav Kook, he felt we need to bring back the study of the Jerusalem Talmud. And we'll see if this even has halachic implications. We'll see next class with conversions. I've never investigated the issue myself, but it is alleged that he used to more than he should have. That is, he plagiarized Louis Ginsberg's volumes on the Yerushalmi. Ginsberg also wrote a commentary on the Jerusalem Talmud. I can't say whether that's true. There's a fine line between using and between plagiarizing, and he wrote to Louis Ginsberg, and he had a relationship with Louis Ginsberg. So not having investigated, I would say that he used it a lot. It's thought to be a very good commentary on the Jerusalem Talmud, but it's not quoted by scholars per se, because it's more, when I say he uses Ginsberg, he doesn't use Ginsberg's scholarly academic discussions, more in terms of the pshat, things of that nature. And if you want to study the Jerusalem Talmud, it's a great commentary. It's been out of print for many years. The problem with the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, is we don't have Rashi. Yeah, we have the Karbonet, we have the Pnei Moshe, but we still don't have those standard commentaries. So he gives you a good commentary. I've only glanced at it. I haven't looked carefully at it. He also has a book, incidentally, which scholars do take very seriously, and that's his book on the Vilna Gaon and the Yerushalmi. He has a whole book on the Vilna Gaon and the Yerushalmi, which he wrote after his term as chief rabbi, which shows how important the Yerushalmi was the Vilna Gaon. That's a very important work. We can't really speak about it. It's more of a popular work. It's more of like it's an art scroll type. He's trying to give you the commentary. It's Yerushalmi HaMafarash, I think is what it's called. So he's not giving us Kiddushim there. It's more of and in recent years, the Jerusalem Talmud has become quite popular. The Gera Hasidim have instituted a Daf Yomi in Jerusalem Talmud, and there are about four, maybe three, commentaries now, simple commentaries, art scroll type of commentaries in Hebrew on the Jerusalem Talmud. So it's a real revival. I shouldn't say revival. It's the first time in history that Jerusalem Talmud was being studied so intensively. So it seems to be taking a few seconds before people type and it appears. So we'll see if there's any other comments or questions. Those who want to buy the book, Rabbi Shlomo Goren, Urim Publishers, It's actually a wonderful book. I will speak a bit more about it next class. It's not a Haredi biography. It's a real biography. It's between hagiography and biography. But it's not an art scroll book. It's not an academic book, but it tries to keep a distance from, as I'll mention next class. And it's really quite good. I'm very impressed. Okay, well, no one else has any more questions then. We will pick up next class. Next week, continue with Rav Goren. Good night to everyone. Thanks. Good night, everyone.